Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we've got some related segments, related news, if you will. First, we're going to be speaking with journalist and author Natasha Leonard about the ridiculous but also dangerous backlash against critical race theory. It's, it's the latest. You know how these panics go. But in red states, lawmakers who claim to be champions of free speech and who say they abhor cancel culture are using the power of the state to constrain speech about race that makes them uncomfortable. And I guess cancel anyone who gets in their way. There's no point in calling out hypocrisy, though. It's ubiquitous. And nobody ever promises to be consistent. So there you go. Then we're going to be speaking to Noam Lupu. He's a political scientist at Vanderbilt University. And he studied the much-discussed white working-class voters, these people that we obsess over and have for like 5 years, and found that, contrary to the conventional wisdom, Trump did not energize this group of voters. In fact, according to Lupu and his colleagues, he ended a trend of that group moving toward the GOP, although it's probably too soon to say he ended the trend. But at least in 2020 broke from that trend. What happens next remains to be seen. First, I want to talk a little bit about another piece of conventional wisdom that seems sketchy to me at best. And that is the very common storyline that the GOP is being torn apart by an intra-coalition civil war. And, this is something that, the political reporters love these stories. It's catnip. Any intra-coalitional, intra-party intrigue is catnip. So the big story in Washington this week, oddly enough, given everything that's going on, centers around efforts to shun Representative Liz Cheney, the very, very right-wing lawmaker, for calling out Trump and her many colleagues who supported his crackpot coup attempt. And the thing is, there is no civil war here. The safe money is on Cheney, who's, obviously the daughter of Dick Cheney's Republican royalty, being stripped of her leadership position and replaced with Elise Stefanik, the formerly moderate Republican from New York who went all in on Trump's big lie, helped him in his efforts to overturn the result of the election. And it's not just Cheney, right? Mitt Romney, the party's 2012 nominee, was booed lustily by members of his party in Utah. And many of us had thought, I thought that he was uniquely positioned to go up against Trump on certain things because his base, his Mormon base, was more loyal to him than to some New York real estate scummy developer who just found Jesus when he decided to run as a Republican, right? The conventional wisdom, again, often wrong, was that they were, the Republicans in Utah had more affinity for Romney than for Trump. And that just wasn't the case. And, it's likely, I think, that all of the Republicans who voted to impeach Trump, or who even, or many of whom who even just accepted the results of the election, will see their careers in Republican politics end. And more than that, the big lie continues to be popular within the Republican Party. It's embraced by the vast majority of the base, but also a lot of office holders, at least because they have to, even if they don't actually believe it. And in Arizona, it's pretty much the entire party is behind this ludicrous audit of the ballots. If you haven't been following that story, it's absolutely nuts. They hired these like QAnon conspiracy wackos to audit the ballots and then gave them like 2 million ballots from Maricopa County, The Department of Justice is getting involved in that. It's a big mess. They haven't secured the ballots. And also the convention center where they rented to count the ballots, like they booked high school graduations afterwards. They're going to run out of time. It's just a ridiculous mess. And if you look across the country, you can look at primaries, you can look at races for party leadership and the like. And it's just this very consistent pattern. It's very consistent pattern that the small number of Republicans who say that the election was fair are being shunned. There's no civil war, right? It's like one faction is completely dominant at this point, and it is crushing any apostates. Meanwhile, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell put the most difficult Democrats in the Senate, the ones who oppose filibuster reform and all other efforts to defeat minority rule, seemingly, into a very tough spot this week. And I just want you to listen to what he said. Compare these two statements. One is from 2010 and one is from Wednesday, this Wednesday.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
Yeah, 100% of my focus is on stopping this new administration.
Okay, so there he is. He's saying that he has, just as he did in 2010, his only objective is to block Joe Biden. And this is problematic for McConnell and for Republicans in the sense that, you know, they've been calling out Biden for not unifying the country, not pursuing things in a bipartisan manner. And here they are. They're saying it again. This is all that they care about is blocking Biden. And it's also difficult because so far, the three big bills that Biden has brought to Congress and asked them to pass, COVID relief, infrastructure, and this CARE bill with child care and elder care and the like, expansion of the Affordable Care Act, all of those are extremely popular. But it's a problem for senators like Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, the senators, the Democrats who have said that they want to preserve the filibuster to make the Senate functional, right? Which is incoherent. Manchin has said many times that he thinks he can get 10 Republican votes for various Democratic proposals. And here's Mitch McConnell, right? Coming along, showing that us hippies are right when we say that the GOP is completely unserious about governing, can't be considered a real negotiating partner, right? Here he is, just proving our point for us. Thank you, Mitch McConnell. And this has been a theme that I've been on a lot, that, you know, this filibuster fight, some of our best allies, some of progressives' best allies in this filibuster fight, are Republicans. Because in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except for death, taxes, and Republican obstruction and overreach. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break. Take a listen to this. This is a new tune from one of my favorite bands, Southern Culture on the Skids. Enjoy, and we'll be back with Natasha Leonard in a minute.
Don't steal the job, don't steal the job, don't steal the job, no. Don't steal the job, no. Don't steal the job, no.
don't spill the java, don't spill the java, no. Don't spill the java, don't spill the java, don't spill the java, no.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. And frankly, I'm a little surprised that we haven't had our next guest on in the past because she is such a smart writer. Natasha Leonard writes a column for The Intercept, and she writes elsewhere as well. She teaches at the New School, and she's the author of Being Numerous, essays on non-fascist life. And God knows we need more insights on non-fascist life right about now. Natasha Leonard, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Thank you for taking the time. So we're witnessing this massive angry backlash from much of white America, the Fox News coalition, on a number of different fronts at the same time, it seems. We talked the week before last about efforts in red states to stigmatize transgender people. There are other fronts in which this backlash has become a legislative priority. They are having a kind of full-throated tantrum in the culture wars. Just this week, we saw a lawmaker in Tennessee, a Republican named Justin Lafferty, defend the three-fifths compromise. He defended that. He said it was a good thing. He said it was designed to make slavery go away, some convoluted reasoning. The three-fifths compromise, of course, was held that slaves were worth three-fifths of a person in order to give slaveholding states representation that was disproportionate to their non-slave populations. Ron Hanks in Colorado, another Republican lawmaker, said this. Let's listen for 1 second.
Being called Mr. Lynch might be a good thing for what I'm about to say. No, just kidding. Going back to the founding and going back to the three-fifths, I heard the comments and I appreciate them and I respect them. But the three-fifths compromise, of course, was an effort by non-slave states to try to reduce the amount of representation that the slave states had. It was not impugning anybody's humanity. It was an effort to... Well, it's important to say we had this conversation on one side. Let's talk about it on the other. Is this really racist to be talking about what the three-fifths compromise was? I don't think so. And I think it's important. It's a part of the civics lesson here. It was brought up, and it merits discussion. That was an effort by the North to try to keep the South from having too much representation and push slavery beyond. And ultimately, it worked out. Took a war to do it, took 600,000 American lives, took a lot of treasure. That's the kind of thing that ought to be taught. We can talk it, I guess, maybe this is a contentious issue. It seems like I didn't think it was when I came up and said it, but the hisses have proven me wrong.
And then last week, Salon reported that, and I quote, during a local Louisiana House Education Committee hearing, Republican State Rep. Ray Garofalo argued that the state's public schools should teach students about the good part of slavery. Woo! The good part of slavery. This is a Trump effect, huh? I mean, have you seen such a the abandonment of coded dog whistles before?
Well, you know what? It's everything you mention is wild, and it is playing out, across red states almost without exception, in the same way that you're seeing, as you mentioned, such a terrifying assault on trans youth and trans life in general. But as it comes to anti-racism and the creation of critical race theory as a buzzword, detaching it from its really quite established history in Black-led legal scholarship, and it being kind of transmogrified by the right into this buzzword for all the terrible wokenesses that are devastating America and its white children. And yes, it's obviously in this precise moment a continuation of the Trumpification of the Republicans and that, a hangover of that very unfinished business. But it also has a much longer history. This is not some sort of aberration in reaction, specifically racist reaction. And I think there's, given the way the discourse plays out now, we have a tendency just to frame this stuff in terms of culture wars, like, oh, you've got, you know, the right wing conservatives reacting to kind of overzealous liberals in schools and institutions. But really, I think this fits more firmly and securely in a pretty unbroken history of Black liberation struggle being responded to with what the scholar Cedric Robinson has called the rewhitening of America. And you saw this in post-Reconstruction America. You saw this in Jim Crow. You've seen these kind of backlashes, and backlashes are precisely the word, every time there has been a major push for racial, social, and gender justice and an undoing of the realities of the oppressive state that is this country, this kind of very rabid pushback against that. And what we have to remember and be cautious of, because even though these things seem so absurd, right, and just so cynical, so base pandering, and so vile that it's tempting to want to just say, like, how can we even deal with this? But we don't have this great history of, you know, the arc of time bending towards progress. A lot of these historical rewhitening moments, this shoring up of white standing in the US, have been incredibly successful. Like, yes. We did take the wrong route from Reconstruction, right? So this is what we're seeing now, and it has to be taken seriously. As you mentioned, Idaho has now made it law that school funding, considerable school funding, will be cut for any school that seeks to teach that the very fact-based reality that merit-based systems are structurally racist, that America is foundationally racist, that we have to deal with you know, a history, an unbroken history of coloniality. None of that can be taught without risking funding. And we're also talking about extraordinarily white states, right? Like Idaho, where these laws are now being reified, and the governor has signed this into law.
Yeah, that was the first one.
Yeah, and you know, Tennessee's following, Texas. It's, you know, this, it won't just be Idaho. Idaho is 93% white. So this is often where you see these kind of sites of panic, and panic about white genocide, in places where white standing is actually not remotely under threat. But the desperation with which you see the forces of reaction want to hold on to it, it's really scary, whilst being obviously absurd.
Yeah, it is. It is absurd. And I mean, this is something that I've been struggling with in my own careers. I've been facing burnout, and part of the burnout is that there seems to be a bottomless well of bad faith nonsense coming from the right. So, you know, you sit down, you say, okay, I'm gonna debunk like their nonsense about, like, you know, Mr. Potato Head's gender thing, and then there's another one. You know, the next day there's just another mindless kerfuffle. I would love to get to a point where you could just say, look, this critical race theory thing, it's the same bullshit from the people who wanted you to be scared of Sharia law being imposed in like Oklahoma, right? Remember this? For like 10 years, these people were like, oh, Sharia law is coming. And this is just the latest from the same people. They wanted you to be terrified of the caravans of desperate refugees. It's just always something. And you're right to say that you can't just, you know, you can't just say, look, these people are crazy. There is serious stuff going on here. And that is especially true when you come to these laws that they're passing. And you mentioned Idaho. You wrote about Idaho for The Intercept, but these laws are also being advanced or at least considered in Texas, Arizona, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and elsewhere. So this is a serious thing. And you wrote about it, this in Idaho. Let me quote you. Said, Joe Biden rolled back the Trump administration's attempted federal ban on critical race theory, a term so garbled through reactionary misuse that its history in Black-led legal scholarship is consistently forgotten. For the reality-based community, what is critical race theory? I'm sure, by the way, I'm sure that absolutely zero people furious about this can tell you.
Right. So his critical race theory came out of legal scholarship as a way of pointing out that our legal systems, by presuming a certain type of universalism, structurally failed to enact justice because of history, entrenched histories of oppression in this country. So that it's through these sort of legal thinkings and quite careful scholarship that we were able to start thinking seriously about things like, you know, affirmative action and Title IX style considerations of, you know, gendered violence, but applied to an anti-racist framework, and just understanding that the presumption that this country and its foundations and the legal system and other sort of establishment modes of governance that were born of it could have somehow over time extracted themselves from their racist basing. And critical race theory is just, you know, from the 60s was really when this thought started being taken seriously in the academy, and then more established throughout the 80s. Just people saying, like, look, we have now, you know, over two centuries showing that these kind of assumptions of universalism applied in the legal system is not producing justice. We have to be critical about how race already functions
right
in this country and its institutions and its judicial processing, because it's not trying to introduce race as a question. It's saying race has been introduced. Race is foundational in a kind of settler colonialist nation built on slave labor. You know, race is foundational, and it's time we think critically about how that has affected our systems. And
Are we teaching any of this shit to kids? I mean, is this even an issue in... Because they want to, you know, they're going on and on about, it seems to be that basically there is the development of very simple criteria in public schools that's like anti-racism education, not some deep re-examination.
Reality with a 10-year-old. I mean,
right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, okay.
But, you know, there are, obviously most schools are not, you know, well-versed in addressing historic American racism and European colonialism. And we tell these stories of the nation's birth and the nation's foundation in wildly white supremacist and mythic ways. There yes. has been effort to shift that for the better. And there are examples of how that can work, and that actually, yes, it is complicated to explain to a child that no, race, black and white, are more than just skin colors. These are constructs. They are established historically and contingently, but that doesn't mean they are not material. Like, this is kind of complicated stuff.
Yes, it is.
About materiality and race construction and oppression, but it can be done. And there are examples like the 1619 Project curriculum that kind of tries to give a kind of mapping of how you could deploy this kind of thinking in a way that children can well understand.
But all of that is, I'm sorry to interrupt, but all that is, it's age appropriate, right? I mean, there is not some, I hesitate when we even do a segment like this. I'm always like, you know, I don't want to give credence to the basic premise. So the basic premise is false. I mean, we're not teaching kids radical.
No.
I mean, you know, not school children. Obviously, you get to college, it's a little different, but.
And even then, you know, it's not. But what I would also add is that, like, to be sure, a lot of anti-racist trainings and efforts, be they in workplaces, universities, or in schools, I have no doubt that they're handled pretty badly often.
Yes, yeah.
Not across the board, but I'm, you know, I don't want to say, like, oh no, everyone who's taken this up has done it in, you know, the true Black liberation movement spirit. And, you know, I think there probably is a lot of kind of petty reframings that, you know, don't help us understand these things as materially and historically situated. I'm sure a lot of this is badly taught. You know, anyone who's done, you know, workplace diversity training, I certainly have had to at the university, it's often very banal, often in itself seems somewhat garbled on how it understands what race is and how it functions. So I'm not going to kind of stand up and give a standing ovation to liberals with a kind of an equally mangled understanding of identity and race. I don't think it's this perfect thing on the table, but obviously these forces of reaction are so much more dangerous than the efforts to try and bring a racial reckoning into schools.
You, in your piece for the Intercept, you referenced this a little earlier, but this is a great quote, so I want to read it. You quoted Lawrence Glickman, actually, writing in The Atlantic. He wrote, and I quote, "Backlashes appear as seemingly serial and discrete events against the civil rights movement in the 60s or the women's movement in the 70s or the gay rights movement in the 90s. But this obscures an underlying continuity. These individual backlashes are all instances of a reactionary tradition that is deeply woven into American political culture." This is so fascinating to me. And I wonder to what degree you would connect like the Black Lives Matter protests last year. Obviously Donald Trump's election as a backlash against Obama's election. This idea of that wokeness is a threat to America, even while the people who are anti-woke are trying to limit other people's speech, et cetera, et cetera. Is it all just a big tapestry?
Well, I think, these things can't be disentangled from each other. And I do think this is, it sometimes when you're just reading about it on Twitter or looking at the news, it can seem like a lot of these reactionary hyperpanics are maybe in response to Biden saying that he is interested in, giving funding to teaching about racism in schools. But actually, I think it is a more powerful reaction to, as you mentioned, the uprisings last year. I mean, these were the most potent Black liberation, Black-led uprisings in a generation. And so I don't think it's an accident that you are seeing a lot of really, really panicked reactionary responses from the right, because this was, a genuine and seemingly in its force, non-co-optable uprising. It wasn't just, a Biden initiative that you can write off as liberal pandering. It was a Black uprising, and it was, really powerful and important, and hopefully not a thing of the past in any way. But I think that has triggered an incredible backlash from the racist right. And then they have this ability to kind of defang and quash all of these debates into issues of wokeness. Whereas actually what we're talking about is quite a serious struggle, right, of genuine fights and unfinished fights for liberation and very, very powerful forces of counter-reaction.
Right, right. And I mean, I always think that it is important to understand these things on multiple levels at the same time, because you have these big structural issues, these big fights that have been going on, as you say, back to Reconstruction and before. And then at the same time, it is also the truth that, for example, Morning Consult has a poll out today which finds that 6 out of 10 people support Biden's American Families Plan, right? And the numbers were higher for infrastructure and COVID relief. So at the same time, this is also about not having a substantive argument and needing to terrify your base about these scary boogeymen who are in reality not, eating babies and taking away guns from Santa Claus, but are in fact, passing universal child care credits and the like. So it exists on both of those things as a multi-generational fight and as a petty distraction from, petty partisanship, as an act of petty partisanship as well.
Right. And I think these things have always historically gone together. Like, when people name certain rhetorics that seem absurdist as a distraction, it's like, well, when they are the rhetoric of, the majority of a given party that is, in charge of a huge number of states, it's not just a kind of distracting rhetoric. It speaks to the structure of the politics of the now, which you aren't like, it's been made quite clear that the Republicans are going to do everything they can to, you know, uphold white standing and enforce some sort of like Heron Voke democracy. And, you know, it's all masks are off. This is just absolutely clear.
Yeah, all the masks are off. They're suppressing the vote. They're passing laws that indemnify drivers from running over protesters. These things are extremely, extremely clearly related. Natasha Leonard, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Woke up feeling great. The birds are in the trees. They're singing me a melody. La 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 la, fuck the police. My head is on straight. My heart is in peace. My soul is incredibly ready to change history. It's a good day to fight the system.
To fight the system.
It's a one of us is tired out, the other one will hold it down. We're gonna spread the love, we're gonna spread it around. We're all over the city now, and way down in the underground.
Welcome back. I'm happy to welcome Noam Lupu to the show. Professor Lupu is a political scientist at Vanderbilt University, and he co-authored a piece in the Washington Post last month with Nicholas Carnes titled, "Trump Didn't Bring White Working Class Voters to the Republican Party. The Data Suggests He Kept Them Away." This was based on their research, and I have to say I'm always really grateful for analyses that kind of expose flaws in the conventional wisdom. Professor, we've got issues.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. I should point out that Nicholas Carnes and his colleagues were some of the first to discover that the penalty that used to adhere to politicians who were too explicit in their appeals to racial grievances weren't showing up anymore after the Obama presidency, which I thought was really interesting. And it connects to the last segment and also to some of the stuff that we're going to discuss in this segment. You know, political scientists had always found that if you're too explicit, if you don't, you know, use the subtle coding, voters would punish you. But then after Obama, somehow that was not showing up in the data the same way. Anyway, it's hard to understate how deeply and widely held the belief is that Donald Trump was a white working class whisperer who was unique in his ability to turn out this group of voters. It has been the basis of a lot of punditry, of a lot of analyses. A lot of Republicans have run with it, claiming that they are now the party that represents working people, even as their policy agenda suggests otherwise. And you write, and I quote, "White working class support for Republican presidential candidates has been slowly increasing since 1992, that is until 2020. And last year's data suggests that after Trump's term, the rate of white working class support for the Republican presidential candidate fell for the first time since 2008 and possibly even earlier." Professor, what is going on here? Do we know?
Well, I don't think we do know. We know that there's sort of a long-term trend And, you know, we know that that trend has slowed or maybe started to reverse this year. But beyond that, I don't know that we know a whole lot. And, you know, I would just add that, you know, whether a long-term trend is reversing is also not something that you can tell, you know, from one election to the next, right? So there's, in some sense, the jury is still out.
And especially when the last election was conducted in the midst of a, you know, historic public health crisis. It certainly was not a, we can't say 2020 was typical in any way. Yeah. Part of the story, I think, is that there was a lot of anecdata, right? We had a lot of reporters kind of parachuting into rural areas, and they talked to some white working class Trumpers, and boom, there was like this narrative was born. But yeah. I want to ask to what degree it was also about kind of different definitions of what it means to be white working class.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's an element to that definitional question. I would say, so we, in the work that we've done, we look at, ideally, we would look at people's occupations. I think that's, you know, widely considered the best way to think about social class. The kind of occupation that you have, you know, socializes you into different, you know, ways of thinking about the world and thinking about politics. Most surveys and most polls don't ask questions about occupation, in part because it takes a long time. You know, people don't know how to describe their occupation, and then you get lots of information and you have to sort of figure out how to put people into buckets. So lots of people look at college education versus not college education, and they say, well, you know, white Americans who don't have a college degree, that's working class. And the problem with that is that at this point, 60-something percent of Americans don't have a college degree, and it's not the case that 60-something percent of Americans should be thought of as working class. A lot of right. those folks are very, very affluent, small business owners, very successful small business owners. So a lot of the narrative is based on that, and it's certainly the case that there's a sort of education divide in American politics. But a lot of that is being driven by affluent people who don't have a college degree. And that seems very different from saying that it's being driven by the white working class. So we look at people who don't have a college degree and make below the median income in, you know, whatever the particular election year is. We think that's a, you know, absent information about occupations, we think that's a reasonable way of thinking about the white working class. And when you do that, the trends look a little bit different.
Yeah, I mean, it is really important to understand that there were, I think the kind of avatar of what you're saying was that woman, I don't know if she has a college degree or not, but she was, she ran a like nail salon or something. She was a fashion stylist, something like that. And, yeah. and she flew to the insurrection in a private plane. So, yeah. you know, the idea that, you know, if you, that these are discrete categories, that there aren't people who lack a college degree, but are extremely affluent, is kind of problematic in all of this. You wrote, and I quote, "The biggest single year increase in the white working class's share of GOP voters came in 2012 when Mitt Romney was the party's nominee." This reminded me of something that John Sides, the political scientist at George Washington University.
Actually, now at Vanderbilt.
At Vanderbilt. Oh, I'm sorry.
My colleague now, yeah.
Your colleague at Vanderbilt. I haven't had him on for the show for a year or so. So now at Vanderbilt. So John Sides did this study with a voter study group, and he was looking at Obama to Trump voters. And one thing that he said on this show, he didn't actually publish this, but he said that one thing that he found was that between 2008 and 2012, there was a sharp increase in the percentage of white non-college voters who perceived that the Democratic Party was to the left of the Republican Party on the issue of how much the government should help improve the status of African Americans, which I found just fascinating, because the thing that he was saying was like, you know, there was so much talk in 2008 about the rise of the Obama coalition, which was, you know, urban liberals, women, and people of color, that it really cast the differences between these parties in this area in sharp relief. So let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. I've asked this of a lot of people in your field, and I often get different answers. Lyndon Johnson, supposedly, I don't know if this was actually, if he actually said this or not, but Lyndon Johnson, when he signed the Civil Rights Act, he supposedly told my old boss, Bill Moyers, that he had lost the South for his party for a generation. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was a great underestimate, given that the South went from solidly Democratic to solidly Republican in the ensuing years and has remained that way. But the question is, to what degree should we all see this as kind of a continuation of that movement inspired by the Civil Rights era, that began at least in the Civil Rights era and has continued as we see these continuing fights for Black emancipation or equality, however you want to put it? I mean, is it just a process that began in the South and is ongoing?
I think it is. I mean, I think it's a combination of things. You know, after 2016, there's been a lot of debate about, you know, are these voters, and, you know, even after the, you know, January 6th, is this being driven by economic anxiety or, you know, race? And I think a lot of the political science research has suggested that race is playing a big part. And that's consistent with the idea that, you know, a lot of this happened or started to happen during the, during Obama's first term, rather than, you know, with Trump. But I've become increasingly convinced that it's actually very difficult to distinguish those two things. And, you know, it might make sense to talk about them as separate ideas, that, you know, you're driven by sort of economic concerns, or you're driven by race and, you know, racial resentment or something like that. But my guess is that it's actually very hard for people to distinguish those two things. That some of that is even sort of subconscious, right? This sort of the idea that you have an African-American president and this new Democratic coalition in the midst of, you know, the biggest, you know, recession, economic downturn since the Great Depression. And after years of sort of growing economic inequality and feeling like your communities are being left behind economically, right? It becomes very intertwined, I think. I'm not convinced that we can actually distinguish those two things, or that people in their minds can distinguish those two different things.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I agree. I think that there was an effort to portray Trump's appeal as a reflection of pure economic anxiety. I think a lot of people like me found that pretty offensive, given that he was using these very explicit, you know, non-dog whistles, dog air raid sirens, right? Like calling Mexicans rapists or whatever. But another piece in that Democracy Fund voter study group that I mentioned, I forget who wrote that study. Could have been Roy Teixeira, someone. What they found was that it was like, the way to think about it was status anxiety. So it's not strictly about, you know, those people are taking from me in a strictly economic sense. It was, you had to look at both of those things, how race and actual economic anxiety intertwine and play off of each other. Mm-hmm. And it's really more communal than individual.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you've probably seen Kathy Kramer's work on, you know, ethnography out in rural communities in Wisconsin. She's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin. And she talks a lot about rural consciousness and the kind of this exact sort of idea of the kind of status that rural folks have relative to urban. And her book actually says very little about race, because, you know, the conversations that she was hearing in, you know, sort of the early or sort of just pre-Scott Walker era didn't really talk about race, but it's all sort of intertwined, I think, for people. And that's something that she's been writing about a little bit more more recently.
Yeah, we should have her on the show. That piece, by the way, I was using my multitasking skills. It was by Robert Griffin and Roy Teixeira, The Story of Trump's Appeal, at the Voter Study Group. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. This is really, really fascinating stuff. And, you know, it reminds me that everything is more complex than it is reduced to in the Sunday gab fests.
Exactly. Yeah. No, thanks so much for having me.
I really appreciate it. I'd also like to thank Natasha Leonard and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you excellent, fine, discriminating people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. She comes in color.